Okay, our scripture reading for today is Mark 8, 21 to 30. Actually, it's 22 to 30. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him, Jesus asked, "Do you see anything?" He looked up and said, "I see people. They look like trees walking around." Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Jesus sent him home, saying, "Don't even go into the village." Jesus and his disciples went on to the village around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Why do people say I am? Or who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. And still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Messiah." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him.
We start with prayer and then we'll dive in here. Pray with me. Almighty God, we gather as your people today with probably a lot on our minds, a lot of mixed emotion of exhaustion and some anxiety and some hope and some relief and some exhaustion. And we lift ourselves up. We also just lift our country up to you at this moment and our divisions. We pray for peace and healing and charity towards one another in our land. We also just pray for our congregation and our nation, our world, as we continue to navigate this pandemic. Calm our hearts in these uncertain times that we would lean more and more on you. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear what you have to say to us this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay. Ron, you can put that first slide up. All right, so this is a sign that sits up at about 12,000 feet, and it's on the top of what's called Cottonwood Pass in Colorado. It's this really gorgeous area in the Rocky Mountains. And my family would frequently visit this area growing up. And it's particularly significant because it's one of those spots out west that marks the continental divide, or sometimes people call it the Great Divide. If you know what the Continental Divide is, it's that often mountainous region out west that separates the two watersheds in our country, meaning that anything that falls to the west of this sign, the moisture that comes down, it's going to seep into the ground, and then it's going to find its way into a stream and then to a river, and eventually it's going to empty out into the Pacific Ocean. Same thing on the east. Anything that falls down is going to eventually make its way to the Atlantic Ocean. As a kid, I'll be totally honest, I was always fascinated by the idea that as a kid, you have to go to the bathroom up there and you can somehow have this choice, you know, Pacific or Atlantic. I don't know that it actually works that way, but that's what I thought as a kid. The reason I'm showing this is because you can take it off now. We've been trekking through the Gospel of Mark now for 7 months. We're going to kind of speed up a little bit after Christmas, but we've been here a while, and we're coming to Mark's continental divide, Mark's great divide. This unit we're in right now is the watershed of this gospel. So we turn here. I want you to recognize that we're at a special place in the gospel. We're going to shift in a number of ways. So up until this point in our story, basically all the action is taken up geographically north. We've been up in Galilee, and most of it's happened around the lake. And as we make this turn, as we go over this mountain pass in our story, the story's going to now relentlessly move towards Jerusalem, towards the cross. So there's a geographic shift that's happening in our story. But there's other shifts as well. oftentimes as we're reading the first half of Mark's gospel, it's just miracle after miracle after miracle. That just seems like they're nonstop. Jesus calms a storm. He walks on water. He casts out demons. He raises the dead. There's miracle after miracle. And interestingly, as we go over this pass, the miracles almost completely cease. There's, I think, maybe three more miracles that we're going to read in the second half of the story, but they basically stop. So if the first eight chapters, if it's marked by Jesus' power, that's what's really prominent. In the second half, it's going to be marked by his weakness. So if the primary question in Mark's gospel at the first half is, who is this? That's the question we keep coming back to. The second half is going to be, what did he come to do? And so as we kind of climb up this pass up into the top, I want you to kind of realize we're at this really prominent point in the gospel. So these two stories, at first, they don't seem like they have a lot to do with each other, but as we'll see, they actually have a number of connections. The first one, and really the most important, is they're going to revolve around sight. So kind of get that in your mind. I want you to see that each of these passages centers around sight. So Bethsaida is a fishing village. It's up on the north side of the Sea of Galilee. Our story begins by Jesus taking this man by the hand and leading him out of town. So this is a very tactile story, this first one. Jesus is going to touch. He's going to use saliva. And it begins with this really tender scene of Jesus taking a man and leading him by the hand out of the village. So it kind of makes you wonder, like, what did they talk about? They're walking outside the village. What did Jesus and this blind man talk about? They get out, and Jesus, he spits on the man's eyes. And so, I mean, in that culture, saliva had some people thought it had some healing properties, so that explains it a little bit. It's still really odd, though. It's one of the first of a number of really odd things about this story. And, you know, it's interesting. Matthew and Luke don't even include this story. It's only in Mark's gospel. It makes you wonder, was this just too strange of a story for them? And then Jesus asked, do you see anything? And so this is actually an odd question, too, because, you know, think back on Jesus' miracles. After he does them, does he ask for feedback on those miracles? Does he kind of perform the miracle and then kind of lean in and say, did that work? No, he doesn't do that. He says, you know, little girl, stand up. And bam, the little girl that was once dead stands up. He says to the man who comes to the roof, take up your mat and go home. And right away, the paralyzed man gets up and walks out. In every other miracle story, Jesus performs the miracle, he performs the healing, and immediately it works. And at times, we saw 2 weeks ago in the Syrophoenician woman, Jesus heals the woman's daughter and she's not even present. So the person is not even there with Jesus. When I was looking at this passage, I had this flashback to being a kid, and my dad is an eye doctor, and he would often, when I go into his office, he would check my eyes. And he would take me into the eye exam room, and he would flip off the lights, and he'd put me in his chair, and he'd flash up the chart, and he would drop this tool. You probably know this. I think it's called a phoropter or something like that. All these odd little dials on and everything. And he would have me look through that at the chart, and as he did that, he would ask for feedback. Is it better or worse? Is it better or worse? Does this adjustment I'm making, does that improve your vision, or does that make it worse? And he's using that feedback to figure out what my prescription is. It seems like Jesus is doing something similar here. He's performing the first stage of this miracle, and then he's asking for feedback. How did that go? And the man responds, I see people. They look like trees walking around. So stop for a second and kind of imagine the scene of what this man sees of people who look like trees. And then those trees are walking around. I don't know what's stranger, people who look like trees or trees that are walking. But the man can see, but something's not right. Something's off. The man's vision is better, but it's still distorted. It's still not clear. He needs Jesus to adjust the prescription. So once again, Jesus puts his hands on the man's eyes. And now after the second touch, the man is His sight is completely restored. He sees everything clearly. So what's going on here? What is the deal? We have these two stages of healing. It takes these two touches for Jesus to heal the man. Does Jesus fail the first time? So when I was thinking about this miracle, I was thinking primarily of the physical eyeball. That's kind of what came to my mind. If Jesus is going to heal this man's vision, he's going to have to heal the physical eyeball. So if there's a cataract, he's going to have to take out the cataract. If there's a damaged optic nerve, he's going to have to heal the damaged optic nerve. But again, I was talking with my dad about this week, and he pointed out that to heal the man's vision, it would have entailed more than just healing the physical eyeball. Because he said so much of our vision is connected with our brains. So something like 40% of our brain has to do with vision. So vision is not just made possible with the physical eyeball, it's made possible with the brain and all these pathways and connections that are in the brain that are formed in our first years of life that make vision possible. And if the brain doesn't have these pathways and connections, it can process light, but it can't really tell what it's seeing. And it reminded me that vision is complex. Vision is complex then, vision is complex now. That might be part of the reason why in Jesus' day, healing a blind person was seen as extraordinarily hard. It was in some ways, some people would have thought it would be easier to raise someone from the dead than to heal a blind person. Healing the blind is a big deal in the Bible. There's actually no instance in the Old Testament where someone who's blind is given sight. So what's going on? You have these two stages. Does Jesus get it wrong the first time, or is it just such a hard miracle that he has to use these two touches? Or is it because that two things have to be healed? After the first touch, the man, he can see, but he can't get his mind wrapped around what he's seeing. It's all distorted. People look like trees, and trees look like they're walking around. His eyes have been opened, but his brain is still confused. So his physical eyes can see what's in front of him, but all these connections and pathways in his mind can't quite interpret what he's seeing correctly. And so Jesus, what does he do? He touches the man's again, and now he sees everything clearly. So hold on to that, because this is going to be important for this passage, because we'll come back to it. So now we go on to the second passage. Jesus now takes his disciples by and leads them out of town. So we have this kind of another connection. Jesus is leading them out of town. And he's taking them to a place called Caesarea Philippi. And this town was located 25 miles north of Bethsaida. So it's a full day's journey. There's plenty of time to walk. There's plenty of time to talk. And the thing about Caesarea Philippi is that it's hard to imagine a more unlikely place for this great confession to happen. So first of all, for one, it's about as far away from Jerusalem as you can get and still be in Israel. It's not a lot of Jewish people that live in this area. Secondly, it was a city that was refurbished by Philip, who was the governor of the region. And he named this city after Caesar Augustus. So Caesar Augustus was a Roman emperor who ruled for 57 years, and he was known as a son of a god. And third, this is the city that was famous for its sanctuary to the Greek god Pan. You want to put up Pan. Pan's a weird-looking god. Pan was half man, half goat. So the bottom of Pan's body was like a goat, and the top like a man. And sometimes Pan, I think in this one, he's depicted with horns. And he was the god who was associated with nature and animals and was the one who would watch over flocks. So Caesarea Philippi had become this religious center for the worship of Pan. And there's this cave outside where they believe that Pan resided. So let me just recap this. So the proclamation of Jesus as the Messiah takes place about as far away from Jerusalem as you can get and still be in Israel, in this kind of like red light district of Israel, this pagan outpost, in a city that's named after a Roman emperor who claimed to be a son of a god. So I want you to see that this question that Jesus asked his disciples, it's a really provocative place to ask this question. I was trying to find some comparison. I don't know if this works, but I was thinking if LeBron James was at the United Center in Chicago where the Bulls play, and he was walking past the 6 world championship trophies that Michael Jordan helped the Bulls win, it would be like at that moment he would turn to his teammates and say, "So what do you think? Greatest ever? What do you think about my basketball skills?" Right? That would be a provocative place for LeBron James to ask that question. This is a provocative place for Jesus to turn to his disciples and say, "Who do people say I am?" The answers, the disciples' answer, some say John the Baptist, others Elijah, and still others one of the prophets. So some are saying, "Hey, it's John. He was beheaded, but he somehow has come back from the dead." Some say Elijah. Elijah, if you remember from back in the Old Testament, he was the prophet that was taken up into heaven in a chariot of fire. And there was this belief that Elijah was going to come back. And when Elijah came back, that was going to be the time they prepared for the Messiah. And then other people, a prophet. So someone like Moses or Jeremiah or someone. And so I want you to see this is a pretty impressive list of people. This is a pretty stellar company that the people on the street are putting Jesus with. But he isn't done. So he asks a follow-up question. So we got this two-stage healing, and now we have these two questions asked. And Jesus says, "But what about you? Who do you say I am?" And this has, as I said, this has been the central question in Mark's gospel. At the beginning, we're told in chapter 1, verse 1, way back there, Mark begins his gospel, the beginning of the good news about Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. So we are tipped off right away in our story who Jesus is. At the baptism, God knows who Jesus is. The demons even seem to have some idea who Jesus is, but no person in our story this far has known who Jesus is. And the disciples have been asking themselves this question, who is this? Jesus calmed the wind and the storms, and they say, who is this? Who is this that even the wind and the waves obey him? And so this whole time they've had this kind of been percolating in the back of their minds, who is this? Who is this? But thus far, they've only called him teacher. And now this breaks out into the open. And Jesus emphatically asks me, point blank, he says, "But you," the "you" is really emphatic here. "Who do you say that I am?" And I think about there's. I think there's some psychological astuteness to this because of asking the disciples this question in two stages, because it's less daunting in many ways to give the opinion about someone from someone else than yourself. So someone asks, "What do you think about this?" Well, some people say this and some people say that. You know, when you actually say what you yourself believe, that's something different. That takes some risk to step out. And Peter does it. He takes this as the de facto spokesperson for the disciples, and he says, "You are the Messiah. You are the Messiah." And this is a major, major breakthrough in our story. Like we are right on top of Cottonwood Pass right now. This is a huge moment in the gospel. This is a watershed moment in the gospel. The whole direction of our story at this point is going to change now that Peter's made this confession. His eyes have been opened. He's had this flash of insight. You're the Messiah. And what does that mean? What does that mean, Messiah? I think oftentimes for us Christians, we use that word or so often that we almost have to remind ourselves, well, what does this mean? Depending on your translation, it either says, Peter says, "You are the Christ," or "You are the Messiah." Both mean the same thing. Christ is the Greek word, Christos. Messiah is from the Hebrew word, but they both mean anointed one. And so for the Jewish people at this time, anointed meant primarily at this time king. And in the first century, the Jewish people believed that the Messiah, the anointed one, would be this royal figure, this offspring of David, who would come and defeat Israel's enemies and establish God's kingdom. So I've mentioned this before. Recognize Christ is not, it's not a last name. It's a title. You know, one way you can kind of remind yourself, it's almost more accurate to say Jesus the Christ or Jesus the Messiah than Jesus Christ, because we need to make sure we know this is an honorific title that Jesus has. Also notice that in our minds, we want to immediately think that, Peter's probably confessing that, Jesus is God. Not necessarily. Peter's not probably thinking that. I mean, Mark is certainly going to show us in many ways that Jesus was divine, but that's not what's happening here. The disciples aren't looking for God in the flesh. They're looking for a king. And what's important to recognize is they're looking for a king who's going to establish the rule right here on earth. They're not looking for some kind of kingdom far away. They're looking for the kingdom of Israel right now. And they think it's going to be the Messiah, the one that's going to do it. And so this is to say this is a politically dangerous claim that Peter's making, that he's the true king of Israel. And I also want you to see that Peter is stepping out and he's making a leap of faith. Jesus has certainly done some spectacular things, but you know, look at they're still under foreign domination. They're still under pagan domination. That hasn't happened. But Peter still, he has this flash of an insight. You're the Messiah. You're the Christ. You know, his eyes are open and he sees who Jesus is, but only partially, right? And we'll get into more of this next week. But Jesus is going to tell Peter, yes, essentially, yes, I'm the Messiah, but I'm not the kind of Messiah that you're expecting. Peter's eyes have been opened, but only partially. His vision is still fuzzy. He has the right title for Jesus. Jesus is the Messiah. But as we'll see, he has the wrong understanding of what it means to be the Messiah. So Peter, he thinks Messiah. He sees Jesus as this person who is going to vanquish Israel's enemies. He's the last thing on Peter's mind is a Messiah who will go and suffer, who will be rejected, and will ultimately be executed. And I just think this is so brilliant on Mark's part to put these two stories side by side. You know, these two stories about eyes opening up. So Peter's eyes are opened, but like the blind man after the first touch, he can only see partially. He can only see clearly. The pathways and connections in Peter's brains, they're wired in a way that a suffering Messiah is a distorted image. It doesn't make sense. I see people. They look like trees walking around. The understanding of who Jesus is to disciples is going to come in stages. Just before this passage, if you remember last week with Mick, they're in the boat and Jesus basically says, you're blind, you can't see. But now they're not totally blind because they see partially that Jesus is the Messiah, but the vision is blurry. You know, they're going to see clearly one day, but it's only going to be after death and resurrection. So who do you say that I am? This is a powerful question. It was a powerful question then. It's a powerful question now. In many ways, it's not just the central question of Mark's gospel. It's the central question that we face today. Who is this Jesus? Who do you say he is? Jesus is the great divide. He is the continental divide of human history. I mean, think about it. The year is 2020. Why is it the year 2020? Well, it's because we use a calendar system that's based on the birth year of Christ or around the birth year of Christ. Christ's birth literally split the world into two epochs, the period before Jesus and the period after Jesus. You know, even people today who would say Jesus is nothing more than a great teacher, would many of them would acknowledge that nobody, no person that's lived has had more effect on the world, has changed the world more than Jesus of Nazareth. And that's why 2,000 years later, this question is still a live question. Who is this? Who do other people say is? And who do you say I am? So think about what do other people say he is? Well, there's a lot of various answers today. There's Jesus was a great prophet. We can hear that sometimes from people. Maybe more common today, Jesus was a wonderful moral example. So in other words, Jesus, he came to earth and he showed us how to live. He showed us what love is and how to be kind and how to sacrifice in these various parts of life. Or often you'll hear in our culture, Jesus was a great teacher. He was this kind of sage. He was a wise man. You know, some people might say he was the greatest teacher ever. Or maybe Jesus is my friend. These are all categories for Jesus. They all capture in some part who Jesus is, but they're not necessarily wrong, but they're insufficient, every one of them. And so even in today's kind of, well, who is this Jesus? There's all these insufficient categories. And Jesus again turns to us and says, okay, what about you? Lots of people say lots of things about me. What about you? What do you say that I am? Who am I to you? And in hearing that question again, we're invited, like Peter, to step into faith and confess him as the Messiah. So that's different. That's confessing Jesus as the Messiah is different than saying he's a great teacher, he's a moral example, he's my friend. Because confessing him as Messiah, that's a risky move. Why is that a risky move? Because you're confessing him as king. And when you confess him as king, after that point, you have kind of one of two options. You can acknowledge that he has the rightful claim on your life, and you can accept that or you can reject it. But if he's the king, if he's the Messiah, there's major, major, major implications on every one of our lives. It's so much easier and so much less risky to put him in the category of friend or teacher or moral example, right? Those people don't need to make a claim on your life. But you put him in the category of Messiah, Christ, King, and all of a sudden you have someone who has made serious claims on your life. The other risky thing about when you confess Jesus as the Messiah is that you begin to have your ideas of who Jesus is challenged. So what's interesting about Peter's confession is that he both sees clearly, he has this flash of insight, and yet he's completely wrong. He gets the title right, Jesus is the Messiah, you're the Christ, but his understanding of who Jesus is completely wrong. His physical eyes have been opened, but again, his brain is confused. The pathways, the connections, they're not there. This is hard. Peter and the disciples are going to have to essentially unlearn everything they knew about the Messiah. Unlearning things is hard. In some ways, unlearning things is harder than learning things, especially if you've learned something for a long time. And Peter has been conditioned and by his culture to see the Messiah in a certain way, and now he's going to have to unlearn that. There was this experiment I read about this week in which many years ago, people were shown two different images. So you know, imagine something that would allow you to see one image with this eye and one image with that eye. And they were both flashed in front of you at the same time, but they were different images. And the two images were, one was a baseball player. So imagine a baseball player flashed to this eye. And the next one was a bullfighter. And then after they did that, they were asked, well, what did you see? They just had a real brief second to watch this. And after the experiment, Mexicans reported seeing a bullfighter, while North Americans reported seeing a baseball player. Which is interesting. We tend to see what we're trained to see. So if I have a choice, if I've got to go one way or the other, my vision, I'm going to go with the more familiar. In another experiment, they would flash all these cards. You can actually do this one online. I did it. It was interesting. And they'll flash a red six of spades. Anybody know what the problem with the red six of spades is? You didn't grow up playing cards, did you? There's no such thing as a red six of spades. There's a black six of spades. There's no red six of spades. And so it flashes something that's off, and your brain has to figure out what to do with it because you've never seen a red six of spades. And what happens is that usually people would either say, okay, it's a six of spades, but they wouldn't say red. Or when I was doing it, I just wanted to see a six of hearts. Why is that? Because I've seen a six of hearts. I know what a six of hearts looks like. When a six of spades is red comes up, my brain says, just see it as a heart. So my brain wants to go with what is familiar to me. In this climactic moment in Mark's gospel, two images flash in front of Peter. One's a triumphant Messiah, and the other is the suffering Messiah who will die. And in Peter's mind, this doesn't compute. He's going to need a second healing. He's going to need his eyes to be healed again. And this is a bit of a sobering reality, I think, as followers of Jesus, because every one of us, and I put myself right there, We all have predispositions that cause us to see what we want to see in Jesus and hear what we want to hear in Jesus. So if two images are flashed in front of us in the Gospels of Jesus, we're always going to lean to the familiar one, to the comforting one. And when a vision in front of us of Jesus is flashed that doesn't align with that, we're going to try to make it align with our predispositions. We're going to, in other words, we're going to see a red of six of spades, even though a red of six of spades doesn't exist. And think about this, Peter's been with Jesus for maybe 2 years now. We talked early on, discipleship was this 24-hour thing. You never left your master for the most part. And after 2 years of being right there with Jesus, his vision is completely off. Like, is there a good chance that our vision of Jesus is off? Yes. I think this is a really good cultural moment in our country to remind ourselves that we all have distorted visions. We have distorted visions of society, of Jesus, of ourselves. And I think this is just a good reminder that we need a good dose of humility. As followers of Jesus, we're going to have some humility. Because if you are serious about following Jesus, you're going to come across visions of Jesus in the Gospels that do not fit your preconceived ideas of who Jesus is. And you're going to feel the discomfort. It's going to feel like you're looking at a red six of spades, like something is off. I'm not sure what it is. And when that happens, when you run across an image of Jesus in the Gospels that's a little bit discomforting, don't brush it under the rug. Don't ignore it. Don't try to cram it into an old category. Wrestle with it and allow that to change your vision of Jesus. See, when you confess Jesus as the King, as the Messiah, he's the one that gets to change the vision. Okay? We want to change who Jesus is. But when you confess him as King, he's the one that gets the right to change your vision, not the other way around. I know I suggested, it's been a number of weeks now, in the lead up to the election, to start your day, not with your phone or not with the news, but with one of the Gospels and prayer. And I know a number of people took me up on that. I would want to encourage you, don't stop, even though the election is over, don't stop immersing yourselves in the Gospels on a daily basis. Spend time with Jesus every day, even if it's just a few lines to meditate on, even if it's a chapter. And ask Jesus, show me who you are. Show me who you are. Show me where my vision of you is distorted. Show me where my vision of you is blurry. Heal these connections and these pathways in my mind that make me see things that aren't there. Remember, like the healing of the man in Bethsaida, it came in stages and it was a gift. It was all Jesus doing the healing. And I think the good news for us here is if the blind man can see again, and if Peter, he's eventually going to see. It's going to take a while. He's going to make some serious mistakes. But eventually, Peter's going to get it. He's going to see everything clearly. That gives hope for us. If we confess Jesus as Messiah, and we then open ourselves up for the King to correct our vision, it may not come right away, but Jesus is going to be at work in us. And Jesus is going to be the one that allows us to see everything clearly. So as we stand at this great divide in Mark's gospel, I invite you again to hear this question. Who do you say that I am? I invite you again to take that confession really seriously that we profess as disciples of Jesus. You are the Messiah, the one I give my life to. Give me eyes to see who you really are.